Hi, Patrick Cox here with a little constitutional language today. The Magna Carta. It's 800 years old, still relevant after all these years.
The World in Words is made possible in part by a major grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities, exploring the human endeavor.
Soundworks.
Soundworks.
From PRI.
The Magna Carta in the pod today, and a special announcement about the next couple of months. So the Magna Carta, what is it exactly? Maybe the best way to introduce it is to rerun some David Letterman. It's about that time. He's been off the air for a while.
It's an honor and a privilege to welcome our first guest to the program this evening, ladies and gentlemen, British Prime Minister David Cameron.
This is from 2012. Cameron, of course, has since been re-elected by the Brits. Not sure how much this performance had to do with it.
Do you mind if I ask you a lot of dumb American questions?
Far away.
It wasn't long till the Magna Carta came up.
When was the Magna Carta signed?
The Magna Carta, who signed it 1215.
1215. Yeah.
The big moment of the Magna Carta was basically people saying to the king that, you know, other people have to have rights.
Right.
It's very important that you respect. Mm-hmm. It was the rights of nobles rather than just the rights of people. But it
the
was the
seeds,
first
the seeds of democracy
about people having rights and the crown not being able to just ride roughshod over everybody.
And the literal translation was what? You have magna.
Again, you're testing me.
Boy, it'd be good if you knew this.
Yeah, well, it would be.
And just so you don't think I'm running this as some kind of a cheap shot at the political leader of the country of my birth, well, I am. But also, I have to say, I had to look it up too. It means Great Charter. To give it its full title, and this really pounds home the point of it, it is in Latin, Magna Carta Libertatum, the Great Charter of the Liberties. And there really is a bit of the Magna Carta, or a little bit of how it's interpreted, to excite everybody. It doesn't matter where you stand on the political spectrum. It's people power. American politicians hold the Magna Carta dear, but not just Americans. Pretty much everywhere that used to be a British colony and therefore developed legal concepts based on British law. All of those places, you'll hear it cited. Nelson Mandela name checked it. I remember being in Bangladesh a few years ago, talking with a lawyer who spent a fair amount of time telling me how awful the British were there, and he was right too. But then he said, you gave us the Magna Carta, you gave us due process, and kind of everything else was forgiven then. Well, I was lucky enough to recently see one of the four remaining original copies of the Magna Carta. It was at Salisbury Cathedral in England. I was there with the cathedral's chancellor, Canon Edward Probert. When I set eyes on the document, I was struck by how small it was, how tiny the words were.
It's very meticulous. It's very clear as well, isn't it? It's remarkably well preserved, actually.
Isn't this the best preserved of the four?
Well, yes, it is, actually. And although we unsurprisingly say that, I think the others would agree with this, the other holders of this document. It's not a beautiful medieval document in the way that some medieval books are, for example, because this is a functional administrative document. But it's a work of remarkable craftsmanship when you consider it's all written manually and made on natural materials and, as it were, by our standards, homemade inks and homemade pens and all that kind of thing. Astonishing, really.
Edward Probert also talked me through the history of John, bad King John, and the noblemen who marched on London, forcing him to sign a document. This document that weirdly lives on today, even though, of course, back then, it wasn't planned that way.
Anyone present in 1215 would have been utterly shocked to know that we were still talking about this document now. It's because it's taken on this a notional value as a guarantee of rights across the board in society and protection against power, quite irrespective of the people involved at the time, and therefore transferable through time. I think that's why it retains such power. It's a guarantee of the little against the large, really.
Yes, which is extraordinary given that it was tailored to a specific situation. Can you give me a sense of how bold a move this was on the part of these barons who had marched on London and ended up meeting with King John in Runnymede?
Well, it was bold partly because they were very frustrated. They felt threatened, really. But they were also picking on a relatively weak king. What was bold, if you like, constitutionally about this document is it was essentially getting the king to agree to a whole lot of contractual rights, which when you think about the notion of monarchy, it tends to see itself as above the wider fray, the determining institution and individual in society. And so for the next stage down in society to be doing, as you say, march on London, holding the king to account, making him agree something he didn't want to agree, that is a very bold thing. The boldness is rather well indicated by the fact that the first thing the king did after having issued this document was get it overridden by the Pope almost immediately.
So this document, it was written in Latin to start off with, and then later translated first into French and then into English. That was just par for the course at the time, right?
Yes, a Latin document. It was an official document. Every document issued in England and probably most of Europe at the time was written in Latin.
And Latin was no longer a spoken language at all at the time, right?
Yeah, no, it would have been used for education, for the worship of the church, for all these administrative purposes. But of course in England, where the bulk of the population spoke English, the nobility spoke French, largely, and the church and the administration was done in Latin. So there were several different languages, even in one realm here in England. And so if you wanted to communicate across the board, you used Latin and maybe had it translated if necessary. Hence the French would be a case in point, because that had a currency not only in France, but also within parts of England, or certain sections of society in England.
So how would you view it as a sort of stepping stone to democracy rather than an actual...
If democracy is a wall, I should think it's about one of the bottom bricks in the wall, actually. It's a long, long way from the Magna Carta of 1215 to a system such as we're fortunate to have at the moment, where we can all vote equally with anyone else in our society of our age. That was inconceivable in 1215.
Right, but I suppose without it, there would have been even fewer rights.
I think you're right. It's an instrument which has made those things possible. One of the reasons being, of course, that Magna Carta, because it was a restraint on power, and because it did guarantee rights of one kind or another, was a very good stick to wheel out at later stages. It was used in a large way against another king, Charles I, about 400 years later. That was another king who needed money, who wasn't really trusted by the next stratum of society down, and who was using all sorts of taxation and other things to get hold of money and wasn't regarded as properly consulting the people he should be consulting. And so the whole business of no taxation without representation in one form or another, not necessarily that phrase, but the notion of it, did come very much into play in the reign of Charles I. And it was used in the 18th century by the Americans, who at that stage, the colonists, were a kind of Englishmen in their own time, but in another place. They then determined that they would not be regarded as English because they didn't trust the English king.
Right. So what was it, the Massachusetts had some insignia, the state of Massachusetts, or the Commonwealth of Massachusetts? They changed it at some point just before the Declaration of Independence and included the Magna Carta, somebody holding the Magna Carta, clutching the Magna Carta.
Yeah, it's a very good stick to beat a king with. And George III, certainly as regards the American colonies, seemed to be another incarnation of a Charles I or of John, a king who was well outside his own rights and very oppressive in what he was demanding. The fact that the kind of historical continuity is a complicated one is not really the point. It's what they were able to seize, the stick that was available there for them to beat their current opponent, was the important thing.
Canon Edward Probert of Salisbury Cathedral in southern England. Now, the Magna Carta is divided into many clauses, the vast majority of which have been completely forgotten. So let's remember them. Over at The Big Show, we have a history guy. His name is Chris Wolfe. Here he is.
The Magna Carta is filled with references that at first sight seem incomprehensible or trivial today. For example, all fish weirs shall be removed from the Thames River, or no town or person shall be forced to build bridges, except those with an ancient obligation to do so. Then there's a bunch of clauses dealing with something that sounds really out of place today, how to handle debts owed to Jews when the debtor dies. But it's all about context, and all these things were critically important to the great lords and bishops who wrote the Magna Carta and forced King John to sign it. Just like today, when you come across a bizarre-sounding regulation, like hardware that's sold with the warning, "Do not eat," you just know that somewhere along the line, someone did something really stupid or abused a privilege. And let's just say that King John committed plenty of abuses. Most of them had to do with finding sneaky ways to take people's property to raise funds, or intimidating people into obedience. Nowadays, we remember the limits that the Magna Carta imposed on government tyranny. But what was probably more important to the people of the time was the protection of property. Now, King John was not the tyrant portrayed in so many Robin Hood movies. In fact, he was a bit of an innovator who was willing to challenge convention, and a patriot trying to fight wars he couldn't really afford. So let's just say he went a little too far trying to achieve his goals. For example, he arbitrarily imposed excessive inheritance taxes, disinherited widows and seized their property, and sold off natural resources that didn't really belong to the crown. He believed in a new idea that as a king appointed by God, he was not bound by the same laws as mere mortals. Kind of like Richard Nixon. So the great barons, the ones who suffered most from all of this, decided to set limits on what the crown could and could not do. And that's why so much of the Magna Carta is about defining property rights and the rights and responsibilities that go along with that, like inheritance, indebtedness, the control of natural resources, the standardization of weights and measures, and so on. So what was up with the fish weirs that needed to be removed? Well, that's a lobbying issue, a bit of a pork barrel, really. Powerful merchants wanted the rivers kept clear for navigation, and so they threw that in for good measure. I guess some things never change.
Chris Wolfe, my colleague over at the World Public Radio program. And now for the big news. Nina Pulczuki's here.
Nice to be here.
Nice for you to be here, and you're going to be here an awful lot more.
That's true. You are going to be taking a little bit of a break, working on another project, and you're handing over the reins of the podcast to me.
The podcast is going to be totally professionalized, and I'm not going to be able to
live up to it
when I come back.
But I'm very excited to be working on the podcast this next month or so.
Can you tell us? Can you give us a little bit of an idea of what you're working on?
Sure. We have a lot of different things coming down the pipe. Everything from the origins and roots of the word cowardice to the Hawaiian term hapa. We're going to do a little investigation into that term. And then we're going to take a trip to the archives of the psychoacoustic lab at Harvard. The lab no longer exists, but the archives are there. And it's kind of an interesting trove of where they actually invented the NATO phonetic alphabet. So we're going to go there as well.
Echo, X-ray, Papa Kilo Lima.
Yeah, you know them all. Alpha, Bravo, Charlie, Delta, Echo. Exactly.
We did a little, there was a thing that we did in the pod about like 2 or 3 years ago with a Danish pop song. It was actually from the time when I lived in Denmark. I managed to find an excuse, some kind of news peg to talk about this song, which is the entire song is...
In order?
No, it's not in order. It kind of sounds like a love song. Echo, X-ray, Papa Kilo Lima, Mike Yankee Tango, India. It's great. They sing it better than I do.
It would be great. But I'm really excited. It's going to be a fun-filled month-long experiment.
Great.
And yeah. I might be calling on ideas from you guys out there. I have a couple of ideas up my sleeve, so we'll see.
Great.
So Patrick, big question. Everybody's going to want to know, what are you going to be doing for this month while you're kind of away?
Well, I'm about to go to Japan. 10 years ago, I did a series on Hiroshima A-bomb survivors and mental health. There's been very, very little research done in Japan or anywhere else into their mental health. In fact, the only major study was done by a guy over here, a guy called Robert Lifton at Harvard. But otherwise, people just don't know about it. And it's a singular condition. It's related to other ultra-traumatized conditions, but there do seem to be some specifics about their condition that hadn't been given much of an airing in Japan. And anyway, we thought it would be good to go back 10 years later. There's another big anniversary. It's the 70th anniversary. Wow. And to do something less on survivors themselves, although I am going to talk to a few survivors this time as well, but on the next generation, the generation after that, so the kids, the grandkids, and so on, and how this has affected them and how the memory gets passed on.
Wow, that's going to be really interesting. And so this we can expect to hear on the world.
Yeah, exactly.
In the next
around
few months.
Around the anniversary, which is August 6th, so a little bit before that.
Great. I'm looking forward to hearing it.
Well, thanks very much, Nina. I've got to say, I am so, so happy that the pod is going to continue while I'm on this other project, and it's going to continue. It's going to be fantastic.
Well, I am like extremely humbled, because I don't know if folks out there know this, but The World in Words is actually how I got my start in radio.
Oh, yeah. We haven't even talked about that. We should do a whole podcast on that.
Maybe we should. But I'm like extremely honored to be actually on this side of the mic after being a big listener for a long time and it being my entree into this sort of world that now has become a career. So I owe a lot to Patrick. And so I'm humbled and honored and excited to
Oh, stop it already.
Whatever. You deserve a lot. So I look forward to doing the best I can. I'm not Patrick, but I will try.
And before I sign off for the next couple of months, let me just tell you that you can find more on this podcast and our previous pods, including the last two on the Icelandic language, at pri.org/language, or on Facebook at the World in Words page. I'm on Twitter too. I expect I'll tweet a bit from Japan at strange times of the day or night. My handle is PATRICOX. Nina will be back very soon with the next episode. Thanks for listening.
The World in Words is made possible in part by a major grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities, exploring the human endeavor.
Soundworks.
Soundworks.
From PRI.